My name is Chuck Haddon. I'm an attorney with Ross Dixon & Bell. I am the ex-hiring partner at the firm. I was the hiring partner for about 10 or 12 years there. And I started doing this talk about 8 years ago or so. Steve had asked me to do some mock interviews for 1L's when around this time when you guys were getting ready to go ahead and do your real interviews, and I suggested to him that maybe it would be more beneficial to actually tell people what employers are looking for. There's a famous Supreme Court advocate, John Davis, he's a lawyer from New York, and he was at one time, up until not too long ago, he had the most arguments of anyone in front of the United States Supreme Court. And Davis was asked to speak at a bar meeting, and they asked him, I think there were going to be judges on the panel as well, but they asked him to speak about certain things about oral advocacy. And he said, well, why would you want to ask the fishermen how to catch a fish when you've got all these fish right here? Well, I am the fish. So I'm going to tell you from the fish's standpoint how to land a law firm job, or frankly, the tips I'm going to give you apply equally to, for the most part, to other jobs that you might be looking for, government, public sector jobs. What I hope to do today is just talk to you about things that are going to sound a lot like common sense. You're going to say, oh, I knew that. And I'm sure that all of you in this room probably did know that, but there are a bunch of people out there who don't know it, and I've got some good examples of people who didn't know the things that I'm about to tell you and could have benefited from a session like this. So since this is being podcast, we'll assume that you guys know everything I'm about to tell you. It's all common sense to you, but those listening on the podcast will not know it. I'm going to break this down into basically four parts. One is just give you some general tips on interviewing, and I'm going to illustrate that by real-life examples from our firm's experience. Many of these are my own experience, and we're going to use some legendary characters. Come on in. Legendary characters such as the Bunny Boiler, the Snake, Lamb Chop Guy, the Bike Messenger, Cable Guy, and Trash Man. Oh, there's a new one, the Restaurant Critic as well. I'm going to give you comments from evaluation forms from people who got offers with our firm and from people who did not get offers from our firm, so you can see some of the characteristics. Actually, they're written on the board, and I'll go through those orally when we get to that. The next part, I'm going to come up with some good questions for you to ask during an interview, and I'm going to give you what my answer would be to the question so that you know what kind of information these questions are designed to elicit. Now, this is the point where I have to give the disclaimer. I heard that one time after I gave this talk, somebody said, oh, well, this was just about his selling his firm and trying to say how good it was. I'm going to tell you, when I give those answers, the answers are going to sound really good to some people, not to everybody, but to some people. So you're going to hear good things about Ross Dixon & Bell. And that's not why I'm doing this. I'm doing it because Dean Hobson asked me to make this presentation. It's designed to help you, but we're not blind to the fact that you might hear something good about us, and if you're someone who's interested in being a litigator in Washington, D.C., or Chicago, or San Diego, or Orange County, California, maybe you'll be interested in us. So there's a disclaimer. Factor that in as you listen, but my goal is to give you the straight scoop from the standpoint of somebody who was a hiring partner and who still is actively involved in the hiring process. The fourth thing that I plan to do is at the end of the session, I'm going to stick around and answer questions, and sometimes that's the most valuable thing because given the number of people here, you'll probably all get a chance to ask a question. So if you've got something, if you don't mind saving it to the end, we'll get to it. I promise to stay long enough to answer everyone's question. And with that, let me just introduce one person to you who's here. That's Dan Cohen. Dan sat through this thing. Dan, is this the third time?
This is.
Okay. This is Dan's third time. He heard it before he was in 1L, and he interviewed with us and wound up getting a job as a 1L. And then he came back for his second summer for part of that, and I've asked him to come sit here so that he can chime in at some points, at least during the question and answer session, share his views on this. And Dan is going to be starting with us full time in the fall. We're thrilled about his coming here, and we've had a number of people who've attended this session who've gotten jobs. So we do try to get reserve one slot for Virginia students in the 1L, in our 1L program. We don't have many slots, and it's very competitive. But I'll get all your names, and I'm going to write down that you get extra credit for attending this session. So maybe you've got a little advantage over your classmates. Anyway, let me get started. And the first thing I would say is, before I tell you how to land the job, you need to do some homework as to what kind of job you're looking for. Is it public sector? Is it private sector? If it's the private sector, what kind of firms do you want to interview with? Where do you want to be? If you don't want to be in Washington, D.C., ultimately, don't take a job with someone in Washington, D.C. This is a precious summer for you in terms of learning things about firms or wherever you're going to be working. Use it. Don't waste it just because it would be fun to be in D.C. or San Francisco or wherever it is you think it would be fun to be. Don't waste that opportunity. And interviewers are going to want to know why you're interested in them. If you've got something on your resume that screams Washington, D.C., it's going to be obvious to me. If you've got nothing on there, I'm going to ask you, well, what's your connection to D.C.? Why do you want to be there? And if you've got a good reason, you ought to tell somebody that. If you have no good reason, maybe you shouldn't have been there. But that's okay. You know, I had no connection to D.C. before I decided to go there. It was just someplace that I had always wanted to go. Think about location. Think about size. There are huge firms. Dan split his summer last year between our firm, which is a mid-sized firm. I think we've got, depending on the day of the week, somewhere between 110 and 120 lawyers in all four offices combined. And that was probably the size of Dan's summer class, or close to it, at a mega firm in D.C. that shall go nameless. Some people want the big firm experience. Some people want a small firm experience. Some people are looking for mid-sized firms. Figure out what you want. Talk to people who've been at the different types of firms, and they can help you make a decision about that. And think about the type of practice. I've gotten cover letters with resumes from people say, boy, I'm really interested in international law or tax law, and I'm really hoping to get a summer associate position with your firm, which would be wonderful if we did either tax law or international law. We don't. It's largely just in D.C. anyway. It's just a litigation shop. So focus your choices on what you think you might want to do. Now, you don't have to be certain about what you want to do. When I was in your position, I thought I wanted to be Perry Mason and be a criminal defense lawyer. So after my summer experience, I went to work for a prosecutor's office and quickly learned that I didn't want to do anything like that at all, and I shifted gears and moved on and quite a different path. But you at least ought to have some sort of interest in it and think that you want to do something. Nobody's requiring you to say, I've wanted to be a litigator since the day I was 3 years old. If that happens to be true, I'm not sure why you would have thought of it that early, but if it happens to be true that you want to be a litigator and you wanted to be one your whole life, let us know that, so when we're talking, we'll have that understanding. But think about what you want to do. Are there things that appeal to you? Maybe in a particular class something came up and you like that area of law. I realize after one semester, it's probably hard to point to any of those classes and say, boy, I really want to do that, or I really don't want to do that. But think about it. You've got some background. You've got neighbors who've done it, friends who've done it. Bring all your good thinking to bear on that. But it's really important not to waste time, yours or the people that will be interviewing you. There's another one of our alumni who just walked in. Welcome, Mamu. We've got relatively few spots to give out for interviews, and we don't want to waste them on people who aren't serious about our firm. And that's true everywhere. When you come up to interview with us, we're going to have four or five people talk to you. And at least for a private firm, that's four or five people who aren't billing time during the time that they're talking to you. Now, they don't mind that, and we don't mind doing it. For anybody who's serious, we have to do it. That's how the firm regenerates itself, and we keep the lifeblood going. But it is a waste of our time, our money, and as much fun as it is talking to you, if you're not really interested, it doesn't help us, and it doesn't help you. Don't do it just to get the practice for interviews. If you want to do that, find a firm that you're really interested in and practice on them, and just don't care if it doesn't work out. How do you go about finding these firms or these other law firm or other legal jobs? You've got lots of good resources available to you. The things that didn't even exist when I was in your position. The internet is a fabulous source. Every law firm, every government agency has a website. You can find out a lot about them through the websites. Ours is www.rdblaw.com. We get lots of good comments about our website. People think it's informative. There are some that are more informative. There are some that are less informative, but you can learn a lot there. And there are other sources. Talk to Dean Hobson, Polly Lawson after she gets back from her maternity leave. There are the NALP forms. If you don't know what a NALP form is, it is every employer that wants to interview has to fill out these forms. And National Association of Legal, I don't know what the P stands for. I don't really know what the L and the P stand for. Pretty sure it's not liquid petroleum, but other than that, I'm not certain. But you fill out all sorts of just factual information about your firm, how many lawyers, how many men, how many women, how many minorities, different things like that. And you can get some information on there that you might not get on the internet through the sites on there. Other sources on the internet, there are things out there that comment about law firms. I don't know if it's still out there. There used to be something called the Greedy Associate, and it had information on it. Don't take all of that as gospel. It's like everything else on the internet. Some of it is true and some of it isn't. But it's there's some stuff on there that you can, if you see 15 posts that are saying pretty much the same thing, at least it's the basis for asking a question about that or finding out some more information. I believe there's a book here. Dan, do you know if it still exists where people write about their summer experience and whether they had a good experience or bad experience? Do you know? Yeah, there used to be. I don't know if since everything went high-tech if that doesn't exist. But at one time there was, I take it you never wrote anything then, saying what a wonderful experience you had.
I'll get right on that.
Okay. There used to be such a book, and it will tell you. And that's actually a pretty good source because the people who actually filled out the forms care enough to say something bad or good about it. If you had a horrible summer and you want to steer people clear of that, you might take the effort to say, hey, this firm stunk. Don't go there. Or this firm was fantastic. Everybody should go there. Or, you know, it might fall somewhere in between on the continuum. But it's usually a good idea to look for that. So this may be the holy grail, and you may be searching for something that doesn't exist, but check with Career Services, and I know that they used to have the book. I don't know if it still exists or not. Another thing you can do, and I don't know if our people took advantage of this, but I've always encouraged them to talk to people who've been at our firm or know something about it, or friends who are more senior to you in law school who know something about other firms. I know Dan has agreed to talk to anybody who wants to know anything about us or what his experience was like. Elizabeth Sullivan, who's same year as Dan, was also with us for a summer. Mahmoud, I assume you'd be willing to do that? Okay. There are professors who know things about firms. There are a couple of professors here. Dean Jeffries did a case with us and got to know us fairly well during that period of time. And I think he would have illuminating things to say about our firm. Professor Armacost was a paralegal at our firm before she went to law school. So she knows us from the inside. So, I mean, there are people who know other firms. You don't have to just look at that, but those are just examples of the kinds of people who might know things. Let me go back to finding out information, because that brings us to our first real-life character, the Bunny Boiler. Does anybody know where that reference comes from? Does anybody see the movie Fatal Attraction? Aha, all right. Michael Douglas, Glenn Close. Michael Douglas is married. He has an affair with Glenn Close. Apparently, Glenn feels more strongly about this than Michael does. He tries to break it off. She says, no way, and stalks him and makes his life miserable. And at one point, sneaks into his house, takes the children's pet bunny, and boils it on the stove and leaves it there. So we nicknamed this one woman who had some stalker tendencies to her the Bunny Boiler. She came up for her interviews, and I remember greeting her in the hall, in the reception area, and as a woman walked, one of our, at that time, associate, now partner, this woman walked by, and she said, "You were born in New Hampshire." And Stacy steps back and says, "Yes, I was." And this woman said, "Well, I was born in New Hampshire, too," and she went on and did that, and I said, "That's interesting. How did you know that?" And she told me that in those days it was Martindale Hubble, and they would list where people were born. And I said, "Do you know where I was born?" She said, "Chicago." And I said, "How about that guy?" And I don't know how she. I guess we had a website at that point, so she matched up the pictures, and she knew where everybody in our firm was born. And I appreciated the effort that she had put into this. I thought it would have been better if she hadn't revealed this. If you're going to be as diligent as she was, and I'm using that term euphemistically there, don't let on that you are a stalker. Don't be a bunny boiler. It'll creep people out. The punchline to the story is she did wind up getting a job with us and worked with us for a while, so we weren't totally creeped out, but it was kind of unsettling at first. Okay, so you figured out where you want to work. Now you've got to prepare your resume. You're selling yourself to people. You're advertising your product, the product of you. You want to make it helpful. You want people to buy. You are the seller. We are the buyer at this point. Make it helpful. Include things on there that are going to make people interested in hiring you. I looked at some of the resumes. We've already gotten a bunch of resumes. If you've happened to apply to us, you should have gotten an email from someone named Rhonda Hill who said, "Thank you very much. We need to get your transcripts after you've gotten your first semester grades, and we're going to start the process then." But some of the resumes, most of the resumes, to get in here, you guys had to be pretty special. There are a lot of very impressive things on there. You know, cured cancer, ran the mile in under 4 minutes. A lot of things are on there that are really impressive. But you also see some things on there that are not so impressive or are just irrelevant. Nobody cares about your high school activities anymore. Well, maybe your parents do, maybe you do still. But for these purposes, it's not that we don't care about them. They don't need to be on the resume. think about what it is, what kind of job you're applying for, and what kind of information people are going to find helpful on there. When you send it in, make it be typo-free. You want to have the grammar right, the usage right, and no typos. When I get a resume that has typos on it, I don't like typos, period, but I especially don't like them on resumes, because employers are looking for evidence that you pay attention to detail and that you know how to do it. And if you can't do that when you are selling yourself, you are your own client at this point. And in theory, you ought to be your most important client. You're selling yourself. You want us to pay attention to you. And if you can't be careful when you're representing yourself, how careful are you going to be when you're representing our clients? So maybe this isn't the right thinking on our part, but I can tell you when people have typos on there, that raises a question. It just makes us pay more attention. So I recommend that you not just rely on spell check, have a friend check it out, have somebody else read it over for you and take a look at it. This next one absolutely goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. It has to be the truth. You can't puff on this. You can't be George O'Leary and say that you had these great credentials and then, you know, get fired from your coaching job at Notre Dame after a day because you lied about what was on your resume. This next one is kind of controversial. Our recruiting committee has split on this. I will give you both views. There is usually a part on the resume where it says activities and interests, and there's some people who like to put sort of quirky, highly unusual interests down there, and there's some people who just put regular kinds of things. And the view of most of the people on our committee is to avoid the highly unusual, quirky kinds of things. Someone once thought it was bizarre for an applicant to put down that he'd seen every episode of The Simpsons. Personally, I thought that was excellent, but that's because I put quirky things down on my resume, and it actually got me, I wound up getting a job that way, or I don't know that that did it, but the place that hired me for my summer was the only place that had asked me to do an impersonation when I said I did impersonations on my resume. And it wasn't Mr. Burns. It was much better than that. This probably doesn't apply to you right now, but be prepared to explain things that might lead to questions. If you have a 1L position and then as a 2L you're applying, someone says, did you get an offer from your first summer? Have an answer for that. Yes, I did. That's a great answer. No, I didn't. That's not necessarily a bad answer if the reason is they don't give offers to 1Ls or the firm no longer exists. If the answer is, no, I was thrown out because I stole money from the coffee fund or something, that's an answer. That's not a good answer. Don't steal money from the coffee fund so you don't have to give that answer, and you'll be better off. But all right. You've got your resume. It's typo-free. You've sent it in. We schedule you for an interview. You're ready for the interview. I'm going to tell you this. You can think it's stupid, perhaps. Maybe you've heard it before, but it actually makes a difference. I won't say it's a dispositive factor, but when you shake hands with people and you meet them, let them know you're on the other end of that handshake. That dead fish handshake is just... it just gets things off to a bad start. So don't crush somebody. We represented Dexter Manley. I don't know if anybody remembers him from the Redskins. He was a defensive end, and we represented him. And I had done some work on a summary judgment that was successful, and Dexter came by and wanted to congratulate us about this. So I went out, and this is the first time I'm meeting him. And I went out, and I shook hands with him, and I had always been told, you know, let him know you're on the other end of the handshake. And I tried to do that. He squeezed my hand, and it was only, this happened 30 years ago, or 25 years ago. It's only about last week that it stopped hurting. This guy just monster. crushed my hand. Literally, it hurt for hours afterwards. Don't do that. That's not going to help you unless you're looking for a job on the Redskins or something. Actually, if you've got that kind of handshake, please go apply to the Redskins because they can use the help. All right. You've done the firm handshake. Now you're in there and you're asking questions, and we're going to get into those questions, and you're going to talk about the conversation and everything. But one thing you need to do, and you've probably heard this before as well, is make good eye contact with people. The key there is good. It's not a staring contest. And that brings me to another one of those characters, those legendary characters, and that is the snake. I don't know if this is true or not, but I've always believed or been led to believe that snakes don't blink, that they have no eyelids and they don't, their eyes don't close. Well, this guy must have gotten some advice like I'm giving you, but took it to an extreme. And during the course of the interview, he was looking at me like this, and he never stopped looking at me, and he did not look away the whole time. You blinked. Well, that's very good. Well, the snake never blinked, but I'm pretty competitive, and when I saw what he was doing, I wasn't going to let him out-stare me, so this became a staring contest between the snake and me, and I don't remember anything else about this guy except that he never blinked. I can't tell you if he got an offer. I can't tell you his name. I just remember that it was so distracting because not everybody is going to do what I did, but everybody finds it distracting when you do that. So somewhere in the middle of the snake and someone who never looks at someone, that's helpful. All right, two bits of advice from Yogi Berra in terms of interviewing. Yogi Berra is supposed to have said, you can observe a lot just by watching. And what I mean by that in this context is, if you've got an interview that's at 10 o'clock, get there at 9:45, and you're going to be shown to the reception area. And sit in that reception area and watch how people interact. Listen to what people are saying to each other. Just get a sense of it. Because when you're in an interview, just like you aren't, I'm not saying you're going to be a different person from who you are, but you're going to show the best side of you. And we are, when we interview you, we're going to put forth, we're going to put our best foot forward as well. When people are just walking around and they don't know who you are and they're not paying any attention to you, you're going to get a little insight into them that you might not see. So if you're sitting there in the reception area and you see people and they look like they like each other and they're talking, they're joking, they're having a good time, that tells you something. If you see them and they're all frowning or they're saying things to each other that don't sound very friendly or they're not talking to each other at all, then that tells you something as well. And you can also, you're in the reception area, see how people treat the receptionist. Because, you know, shit flows downhill. And if they are bad to the receptionist, someday that might be you. You'll be downhill with somebody, and you want to know about that. It's just an indicator of whether the firm treats everyone with respect or not, or the agency treats people with respect. So you can observe a lot just by watching. The other thing that Yogi said, and you're probably more familiar with this one, is it ain't over till it's over. And what I want you to take away from that comment of Yogi's is lunch is part of the interview process, or sometimes it is. You'll have an opportunity sometimes to eat lunch with people at the end of the process. In our firm, you might get four interviews, and you'll go to lunch with two more people. There are people who sort of relax and let their guard down at lunch, and they say things that they wouldn't have said during those interviews just because it's a more relaxed situation than sitting across from someone who's at a desk. And all of the contact is important. You're being evaluated the whole time, and we tell our people who are going to lunch, hey, we're being evaluated the whole time. Because you're both a seller and a buyer when you're in this interview, and you're looking at us. Now, you may think it's fine if we say certain things in the interview that are different from what we would have said in the lunch than we would have said at the interview, but it doesn't always work that way. And let me give you the example of Lamb Chop Guy. Lamb Chop Guy, I'm not sure this is the best example, but Lamb Chop Guy went to lunch, he ordered lamb chops, and there's no other way to say it. He just picked them up and ate them with his hands. He didn't bother with the knife or fork and just picked it up and gnawed on it like it was a barbecue spare rib or something, and it just wasn't very impressive. So my advice to you is you can say things at lunch that get you in trouble. You can do things at lunch that get you in trouble. If you have the option, I would take the afternoon session where you don't get lunch. Unless you're really hungry and need a meal, my advice to you, I've told my son and daughter the same thing, is if you have a choice, don't take the lunch session. Things can go wrong there. You want to get in, make a good impression, and get out. And lunch prolongs that. If you haven't gotten a good picture of people by the time the lunch interviews rolled around, you probably didn't do a good job. All right, many of you are not going to take that advice. I know it. It happens all the time because we give people this option, and people who've been in this session still take lunch. At least take this advice. If you're going to go to lunch, think about what you order to eat. Pasta is hard to eat. Soup has potential for danger written all over it. Just be wise about what you order. Okay, for those of you who are going to ignore that advice, at the very least, if you take nothing else away from this today, do not order French onion soup. Nobody can eat French onion soup with a glob of cheese on there without looking like you're having trouble on that. So don't take lunch, but if you do, don't order soup. But if you do, don't order French onion soup. And if you do, just good luck on that one. Okay? Let's move on to interview specifics. And I'm going to do two things here. One, I put a list of characteristics that on the blackboard here. I'll read those out loud. So that everybody knows what's up there. And what it is the list on the left, your left, those are taken from interviews, evaluations of people who got offers from us. The list on the right is taken from the evaluations of people who did not get offers. The list on the left, and this stuff looks pretty obvious. You're not surprised that somebody who was poised or articulate, relaxed, comfortable, energetic, thoughtful, confident, sense of humor, ask good questions, listen to the answers, that's a key one, and was knowledgeable about the firm might have gotten an offer. Nobody had all of those things, not even Dan, not even Mahmoud. I don't remember which one you didn't have. I don't know. Well, maybe you did have all of those. I take it back. The other side, it's pretty easy to tell somebody, don't be nervous. That'll probably make you more nervous now when you go in there, so I apologize for that. But if you can control that, you know, breathe deep, grasshopper. Do whatever you have to sort of get the butterflies flying in formation. This one you can control. Don't interrupt all the time. You want it to be a dialogue, but you don't have to jump in. Hopefully someone will give you the natural pauses that people who are sophisticated in the art of conversing leave for you to do that. Poor eye contact, we've already talked about it. The wet noodle handshake, as someone called it. I think of it as the dead fish handshake. Being full of oneself. Not exactly sure what people meant by that, but it's sort of the difference between being confident and being cocky. I like people who are confident. I'm less inclined to rate someone high if they seem cocky. I am the greatest thing since sliced bread. You need to hire me. I don't really care about your firm. That doesn't come across well. The lifeless interview is deadly. You start thinking, this thing is only half an hour, and am I going to live through this thing because it seems like it's going to go on forever. Sarcastic people, actually, I don't mind that so much, but others seem to. I think small doses of it might be okay. Showed no interest in the firm. We love our firm. We want good things. We want good people who want to be at our firm. If you don't seem interested in it, we don't want you there. And I don't know why you're interviewing with us, but it's a killer from our standpoint if you haven't shown any interest in us. If you have no questions, that's a good indicator that you don't really have any interest. I'm going to give you some questions that you can ask, and that's one of the functions of this talk. Never shut up. You get people in there who just, we can't get a word in edgewise. We can't ask the questions we want to ask because they are always asking question after question. There's a balance. You got to achieve that. You guys have all been successful throughout your life. That's how you got to this prestigious law school in the first place. You should know these things. You'll know how to do it. The agreed with everything the interviewer said, I don't exactly know the specifics of that, but I have been in the situation where, hey, it's raining outside. Yeah, it's really raining out. Well, oh, it stopped. Yeah, it did stop. Oh, no, it's raining. Yeah, it's raining over there. It's okay to disagree. You don't have to jump on every answer that we give or every comment that we make and agree with it. We're not that insecure that we have to be supported in that kind of way. So just avoid doing it. I think I remember the person said that the interviewee seemed disingenuous as a result. All right, let me read to you from the actual evaluation of Trashman. This will tell you what not to do. And you'll understand why when I finish he was referred to as Trashman. Trashman was a very unimpressive candidate who didn't remember with whom he had spoken, and he didn't appear to have any information about RDB except to say that he had an interest in litigation. Also, he inappropriately referenced on more than one occasion his interest in partying and drinking. Because he asked no questions of me, I questioned his interest in RDB. Someone else's interview with evaluation of Trashman. I was not very impressed with Trashman. It actually uses his name. I'm protecting the innocent, or in this case, the guilty, by substituting Trashman. He did not seem to have the level of maturity I would expect in a second-year student. He told me that he worked in Birmingham last summer because it's hard to get a job, and he had been told it was Atlanta without traffic. He told me he is thinking of working in New York, but is concerned that he would not know where to go with friends, as opposed to D.C., where he is familiar with the bars in Adams Morgan and where to go to get a good cheesesteak. Also, his speaking style and word choice were too casual for an interview, even in a place like this where we pride ourselves on not being too stuffy. He didn't have much to say about why he was interviewing here or what he would like to do, but he was very quick to point out things he does not like. Also, no matter how I tried to steer the conversation, it kept coming back to bars and going out. I would pass on Trashman. All right, and the final one. This was written by our current hiring partner. It is hard for me to put a finger on, but Trashman kind of rubbed me the wrong way. It may have been his nearly immediate disparaging remarks about Wyoming. The football stadium at Michigan, which was where Trashman went to school and my law school, holds twice as many people as the population of the largest city in Wyoming, he said. And his continuing comments along the same line in reference to other cities, Birmingham, Detroit, etc. It may have been the frightening admission that he and his apartment mate stash trash by the door and only take it out when one of them has a girl to impress. I do not think we should make an offer. I don't know if Trashman was doing this on a lark, but if he were sitting here now, he probably wouldn't recognize this as his own kinds of foibles, but you hear it, you've got the benefit of it. Don't do stupid things is the best thing I can say about that. Okay, try to move quickly here to some questions you should ask during an interview or that you can ask during an interview. By the way, so I always get a question, should you ask the same question to multiple people over and over again? And my answer to that is, yes, it's okay to do that if it's a meaningful question and it's likely to elicit a different response from someone. So if you ask me what it is about this firm that I find most interesting or what part of my job is most interesting, somebody else is going to have a different answer to that because they might have a different part of the job that they like. Asking us how many billable hours is our target, we're all going to give you the same answer. So there's no point in just filling up the interview, asking five times and getting the answer 1,900 billable hours is the target, or 1,900 hours of billable, contingent, and pro bono combined is the target. So be selective about how you use these questions. If you've gotten a good answer to it, then you may not need to ask it. If you haven't gotten a good answer, or if it's a type of question where you think you're going to get a different answer, go ahead and do that. Excuse me. All right, one good question. You're going to hear people say, our firm is collegial. You're going to hear us say that. You can hear every firm. Every firm is collegial. Ask them, what is it that makes you collegial? How did your firm get to be collegial? If we were answering this question, and this is, again, this is where the plug comes in, but it's an honest answer for us and something you can compare, I would say, number one, we put a premium on finding people who fit. Although it's very competitive for 1Ls, we don't just go by grades. It's not just good grades. We had a guy, cable guy, who came in and he was, I didn't go to Harvard. You guys aren't at Harvard Law School, so we can dump on Harvard Law School for now. And I apologize to anybody who happens to download this on the podcast and went to Harvard. But cable guy went to Harvard Law School, and he was doing great in his first four interviews. And then in his fifth interview, he somehow happened to mention that he had rigged the system to steal cable. Maybe you've done this. I don't want to know that. I would prefer to think that you didn't. We don't like to hire people that we know are crooked. We also don't like to hire people that we know have such bad judgment as to tell us about stealing cable. So this guy had tremendous grades, law review at Harvard. He seemed to like us. We were on the verge of making him an offer, and we said, no way, we're not hiring cable guy. We're looking for people who are well-rounded. Okay, so that's we seek those people. That helps to make us collegial. We have no set number of partners that we're going to make. If every associate in Dan's class, and I think there are four or five of them in D.C. alone, if every associate in his class performs well enough to satisfy the kinds of things that we ask our partners to do, and has fit in, and by fit in I don't mean that we have one particular type of person. We've got A to Z kind of people, but you've got to be able to get along with all A to Z kind of people. In the past, our track record is that we have made all of those people partners. So what that means for Dan down the road is, hey, I don't have to look over my shoulder to see who's about to stab me in the back because there's only going to be one of us that gets to be partner at the end of the road. We foster a very collegial atmosphere. And as a matter of fact, if you don't cooperate, if you're not collegial with other people, you're not going to get to be a partner there. What that means for you is that's the same theory we hold to for summer associates. There's no set number of summer associates who are going to get offers. If everybody does the kind of work that we expect associates to do, and everybody fits in, that who's eligible for an offer, and 1Ls are eligible for different kinds of offers, not permanent offers, but an offer to come back with the expectation that they'll probably do well, and we'll make a full-time offer then you're all going to get an offer. So it starts very early. And there are other reasons. I'm not going to dwell on why we're collegial, but you'll hear, see what somebody says to that answer, because it's an interesting question. Ask somebody what they did this week or last week, if it's Monday. What kind of things did you do this week on your job? And you'll get an idea of the particular activities that people have. If you go to our website, there is a feature on there. It's sort of a week in the life of an associate, and it's actually kind of entertaining, so you might enjoy that. But those are the kinds. Go there, read that. You'll know the kinds of things that our associates do, and you'll have that as a comparison. How many of your summer associates got offers last year? That tells you something about it. If there are 60 people in the class, even the mega firms can't afford to make 60 people offers for summer associates. They're not counting on that happening. We don't have 60 people in our summer associate class, and we are counting on all of them doing. We don't extend an offer to someone to come as a summer associate unless we think they have the potential for doing well. See what these people say. Now, you may think, hey, I'm great. I'm gonna be the one who makes it through. But it also, it goes back to that collegiality thing. It gives you some idea of the percentages. If they're honest with you and say, you know, 10 people out of 60 are going to get offers, well, you probably are competing against people who are just like you, and are you going to like that or not? Just maybe you will, maybe you won't. I think all of our 2Ls did get offers last year. Traditionally, that's what happens. Occasionally, there's somebody who doesn't get an offer. We had someone once told us that she just didn't feel the need to impress us, and she was successful at not impressing us, I guess. She did not get an offer. But very, very seldomly does that happen. We do a pretty good job of screening on the way in. Ask about what kind of training you'll receive during the summer and what you will receive as a regular associate. You may not think about this, but training opportunities are very important. At our firm, there's all sorts of seminars that go on during the summer program, and then we have a litigation week where you actually, one of us will make a presentation on opening statements and on taking a deposition and on defending a deposition, and I do a session on presenting oral argument of a motion, and then you will take a mock deposition. You will defend the mock deposition. In the trial at the end of it, you won't, but our full-time associates who haven't been through this exercise before will do an opening statement in the mock trial that we have at the end of the week. You will argue motions. You'll have two motions that you argue. So there's a training session. Find about the training opportunities that you have there and what the firm or the agency does that trains people along the way. Do they send you the NIDA courses? Do they have in-house training? We've got a week at when new attorneys start. All new attorneys start with us the same week, except for laterals that come in during the year. And that first week they have no work assigned to them. It's just training, how to fill out your time, how to operate your computer, substantive matters. There's a lot of that that goes on. We do send people to NIDA. We do have in-house training, things like that. That is going to be an important thing to you down the road. You may not realize it now. Think about asking this one. I'm not committed to it. But if you don't have a feel for what this place is like, you may want to ask if people socialize with each other outside of work. That tells you something about it. People in our firm tend to do that. We've had a number of people, lawyers, paralegals, secretaries, who've wound up marrying other people in the firm. It's not a matchmaking operation, but people do tend to like each other, and that's worked out favorably. We play softball. Dan is a great softball player. We're looking forward to having him back on the team. We won the league 2 years ago, right? I think we didn't quite get there this past year. I know softball's big at UVA, so if that's an appeal to you, we've got a good softball team. We've got book clubs, we've got supper clubs, we've got theater groups, golf. people play basketball. We run a gym out and we play basketball. The RDMFL is a fantasy football league that we had. We used to have a golf fantasy league. There's happy hours. Find out what people do and how much they like each other there. Last question I'm going to give you, because I think this will be plenty of questions, is what kind of associate development program do you have? Lots of firms have them. Some firms don't have them. We have one. We've got a partner who's assigned, is the associate development partner, keeps detailed records of professional experiences to make sure no one slips through the cracks in terms of what they've gotten to do. Has so-and-so had depositions? Have they gone to client meetings? Have they been with you when you've gone to court? And if we find that you haven't, then we try to focus your opportunities to get those. We have associate and partner mentors that are assigned to you. We've got the training program, things like that. Those are the kind of things you want to hear if you want there to be an associate development program. Okay, that's the end of it. I will stick around and answer questions for as long as you guys want to ask them, within reason. So fire away if you got something. Yeah?
You mentioned NIDA.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
I forget what the acronym stands for, but it is a group that does training exercises, and they're very good. They put on a trial session. They put on deposition training sessions. The T might stand for training, but I'm not positive. I just don't remember that. But they're expensive, so it's an investment when you send somebody to that. But they're really pretty good sessions. Anybody else? Remember this part? No questions? Just fake one. Come on. Make something up. This is practice for your interviews. All right, good.
Do you ever get questions from 1Ls that you think might be more appropriate for a 2L to ask, you wouldn't advise a 1L to ask? Like partnership structure or something like that? It's really not appropriate for 1L, but maybe relevant for 2L?
No, I don't think so, because I think, at least in our firm, the experience isn't very different. It's just we might give you different assignments because you will have had more types of classes, but actually I don't even think we do that. The only thing, let me twist your question around. I wouldn't ask about salaries or benefits at the interviews. When you get an offer, that's the time to ask about that stuff. It'll be provided to you in all likelihood. If it isn't, then you should ask. But I would find out more of the kinds of information I was talking about during the interview process than the salary benefit kind of thing. From my standpoint, I don't think there's any great difference between the 1L and the 2L. We try not to. Dan's been there as both. I was there as a 1L. I don't think we treated you guys any differently as 1Ls than we treated your colleagues who were 2Ls. To some extent, whoever had time available got the particular assignment. Good question. Well, you don't have to worry about repeating the questions here. I think the interviews here are usually 20 minutes. The interviews back at the office are half an hour. Some people do the half hour interviews here, so you have to be a little more focused in terms. You won't have as much opportunity to make your points. So you really want to. If you've got a good question that you think is going to demonstrate your interest or something you just really want to know about them, don't save it for the end because you might not get a chance to do it. That 20 minutes just flies by. It's really hard. When you're the interviewer and you're doing these 20-minute interviews, it is almost impossible to get every question you want to ask in. So it's the compression factor. And if you don't, when you get a call back, if you don't get a question asked to the first person, you can ask the second person. So you've got a more leisurely pace. I think that that would be the primary difference. You are trying. It's a little. You've already gotten some indication that they're interested in you when they call you back. So you're a little bit more in the buying mode than you are in the selling mode. I think that may have some influence on the way you deal with things when you're on grounds as opposed to on a callback. Anybody else? Yeah.
Is it ever appropriate to ask somebody if you were not offered a job or something like that, if they have any advice or any feedback? I mean, I assume, you know, if you do 100 on-grounds interviews, you're not going to want to give feedback to 100 people. But you know, how far through the process, or is it just not appropriate at all?
I'm always uncomfortable when that happens. It happens rarely that I get that question, and I debate with myself how candid to be about that, because there could be something that's really glaring. Actually, what happens more than that is the interview's going very poorly, and I want to say to this person, you know, you probably have a good story to tell, but you're really not telling it well. Here's what you need to do. You've kind of blown it with me, but for future interviews, maybe you should know this. I've never done that. I did. Someone once called me up and asked me about it, and told me how disappointed they were that they hadn't gotten the offer. And this was a 1L, and this is incredibly. First of all, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't take a no as a ding as a 1L. There just aren't a lot of spots. We've got over 100 resumes from UVA alone, and we've got one, perhaps two slots for 1Ls. So we're going to have 98 people, maybe 99 people, who are disappointed by the answer that we give them. And that's not because we don't like them. And those people, I hope they come back as 2Ls. Most of them, it's just so competitive at the 1L stage. And it's not just us. It's everybody who's like that because there's so many fewer jobs. But there was one woman who was a 1L, and she called me up and told me how disappointed she was and asked me about this. And it did demonstrate to me a little more interest in the firm than I thought that she actually had and that others had thought that she had had. So it did help her cause for the 2L interview down the road, because we talked about it and encouraged her to consider us again and said, look, you don't even have to go through the on-grounds interviews next time. We'll just set you up with a series of interviews. It was close. It just, you know, were people that we liked a little bit more. And the irony is she wound up not accepting the job after we made her an offer. But I always felt bad about that in lots of different ways. I think you would be better off asking somebody if you've done the mock interviews, asking that person, getting some feedback, or trying to interview with a friend or somebody having to do that. You just put the interviewer in a very awkward spot, because nobody wants to say, oh yeah, you were horrible. You know, you were not interesting. You were lifeless. You had no energy. Certainly, that's not how I would say it. But it's really kind of difficult. I would try to get some feedback from somebody on the mock interviews, or go if you find you're having problems with that, go talk to Dean Hobson or Polly when she's back, and I don't mean you in particular, but anyone in that situation. Say, look, maybe I'm doing something wrong in the interviews because I'm not getting much results, and can you help me? Give me a mock interview or something like that. I think that would be better. They may give you different advice. That's what I would suggest. Anybody else? Yeah?
I don't think you can answer this quickly. I have a good simple question. But my experience with law firm is pretty meager, and I don't really know what kind of questions law firms ask. I've been in interviews, I've been asked to build models, make presentations, I've had more questions. Or are you just going to go through someone's resume and give them an opportunity to sell themselves? What kind of things do you have?
That's a great question. Nobody's ever asked that before. But the first question that I always ask is, how'd you wind up sitting on my couch? What was it that brought you to Ross Dixon? Why did you choose to interview with us as opposed to the 150 other law firms that were out there? And I want to know the answer to that so that I can address certain things. If you're telling me, because I like your international law practice or your tax practice, I can tell you, hey, we don't have one of those. If it's, I've always wanted to do litigation, then we're going to talk about, well, what is it about litigation that you like? We're trained to ask questions. We're trained to take depositions and cross-examine people. It's not going to be painful. You're not going to put the light on you and sweat a confession out of you. But we're going to listen to your answers for the most part and follow up on things. So if you say you like litigation, I say, well, what is it about litigation that you like? And what do you think would be fun about litigation? Well, I'm a pretty competitive person, and I like it because you can, it's sort of a way of keeping score. That's my answer. That's what I said when people asked me that. But we will be asking you things about what's your connection to Washington, why do you want to affirm the side? You know, some of the things you're going to say affirmatively, but if you don't, we might ask you, well, are you looking for a mid-sized firm? Are you looking for a small firm? We might say, where else are you interviewing? So if you're interviewing with this boutique firm that has 7 lawyers in it, and you're also interviewing with the largest firm in the city with 1,000 lawyers in it, and you're interviewing with us, it sort of says, well, are you just looking for a job, or do you have some interest in particular? And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, well, for one thing, you're one of the firms that actually hires 1L, so I'm interested in that, but hopefully there's more to it. I'm very interested in living in Washington. I grew up around there. My aunt lives there. I love politics, and I like being in the area. Whatever your reason is, I'm a Nationals fan. I grew up in Montreal, and I want to follow the Expos to Washington. Whatever your answer is, come up with something that explains it. And if you don't have a reason, you probably shouldn't be interviewing with that firm or agency. We'll ask you the types of things that you like to do. Some people ask which classes you found most interesting in law school, if there are any. Which aspects of them that you liked? Do you consider yourself a better writer than a speaker? Just types of things. We're just trying to get to know you. What do you like to do? One of my partners says, what books have you read recently? What's your favorite movie? How many episodes of The Simpsons have you missed? Can you do any impersonations? I don't know. You can get wacky questions. Reminds me. Did I mention The Restaurant Critic? I think I just said where I was going to talk about him, but I never mentioned what he did. The Restaurant Critic asked everybody in the firm that he interviewed with, what's your favorite restaurant in this area? I could see that would satisfy the criterion of, we might not get the same answer from everybody, but you're wasting your time. You've only got so much time there. That really doesn't matter that much in terms of picking this out. If you're really concerned about what restaurants are in the area of the building, go on Google Maps and find out what's there. We're going to play off of what you say, or at least I do a lot. Dan, do you have any experience, or Mahmood, do you want to field this with questions that you guys have gotten?
I think it really depends on what your resume says. And I was a little bit older when I came into school and had some work experience, so I knew there was going to be some questions about, why did you go into the law school? The odds are good that the person who's interviewing you is going to take a look at what it is you're presenting, and pick out one or two things based on what he's giving them to ask you about it. To the degree you can hone those answers in advance so that they're smooth and they sound intelligent and well thought out, you're ahead of the game.
It sounds like you might have had a job in between law school and undergrad. I might ask you, what kind of stuff did you do on your job? Did you have Do you ever have to give bad news to somebody? Do you have to say, this won't work? You want to do X, and X just won't work. And how do you go about doing that? Because we have to give bad news to our clients all the time. You can't do this, or if you do this, you're going to lose, or you are about to get hit with $1 zillion in punitive damages if you think about doing this. And they don't like to hear some of these things, so I might ask you a question like that.
I think what Dan said is absolutely correct, but a great deal of it is about your resume. One thing I would add is that I've found that different interviewers, sometimes even in the same firm, have very different styles in terms of what they expect.
Sure.
And so sometimes it's just a casual conversation for 30 minutes, and you are not actually exchanging anything that you would call meaningful in terms of finding out about the firm. Other times, they don't let you talk, and it's just fire question after question, and it's so combative that you feel like, well, what's going on here? But I feel like a lot of times it's important to assess very early on in the interview which kind of style the interviewer is employing,
right,
and try to adapt to that person's style and to sort of, level with the person. Because if you go in thinking that you're going to get one sort of question, the same sort of questions every single time, you're going to be disappointed because people have different styles, and you kind of have to play on their terms sometimes in the way that you respond to what they're saying.
This may be a false memory, but did we interview?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Just talk to you, because I'm picturing you sitting on my couch, but that was probably when we were working together.
I think so.
Okay. Was that helpful? Okay. Anybody else? Everybody gets at least one. Yeah.
How much of the interview is supposed to be selling yourself as opposed to trying to find out more information about the firm, where you're trying to incorporate both at the same time?
You're both a buyer and a seller. I think in the 1L slot, you're pretty much... Well, certainly on grounds, you're a seller. If you're doing it here, you're a seller. If you're doing it there and you've got four interviews, they've shown some interest in you, or five interviews, they've shown some interest, you can do a little more buying. I think you should always be a buyer. And one thing you guys should know is I will tell you a secret. You can get more interviews. You go through some interviews, and if they're interested in you and they've made you an offer, You can say, hey, I had a great time when I was there. I really enjoyed it. I got a chance to talk to four or five people. Would it be possible for me to come by sometime when I'm in D.C. to just chat with other people? So if you didn't get all your questions answered, you can do that. At least at our firm, you could. If we're interested enough in you to have made you an offer, we want you there, and we'll have people come back and talk to you again. Just realized I never mentioned the bike messenger guy, other than talking about him. I'm sure this is true in other big cities, but in D.C. you've got bike messenger services, and these guys are shooting around the streets of D.C. on bicycles and darting in and out of traffic, and as a driver you're always afraid you're going to run one of these guys over. As a pedestrian, you're afraid they're going to kill you. They are decked out in weird costumes and look like superheroes or street people or some combination of both of those. But they're going around to lots of law firms. One of my partners was up at Harvard. Coincidental again. Don't mean to pick up at Harvard. Actually, this is a good thing, so it's not picking on them. And he started to say, "Well, let me tell you about the people in our firm." And this goes to the "you can observe a lot just by watching" point. I usually mention it there for the Yogi Bear point. And the bike messenger said, "You don't have to tell me about the people in your firm. I was a bike messenger in D.C. for 2 years, and I was at your firm a lot, and I was at a lot of other firms, and your firm was the only firm that treated me with respect." Now, I don't know if that's a unique experience. I don't think we're the only firm in the city that would treat somebody with respect, but I was very proud to hear that answer, that we weren't trying to impress a bike messenger. We weren't putting our best foot forward with him. We were just putting our normal foot forward. And I can take pride in that because I wasn't the one that was interacting with him. This was our receptionist or our office services people who were doing this for the most part. And that was just an, I didn't want to leave off. I promised I'd tell you about Bike Messenger. I didn't want to leave that off this talk. And it really just goes to illustrate that get there early, be your own bike messenger, and watch how people are treating people. Anybody else? All right. Well, you are now well armed to go out and do these interviews. Good luck out there. If anybody has sent us a resume, I hope we've gotten back to you and told you that we're not starting the process until we get the grades. So please send us your transcripts when you get those. And maybe I'll see one of you this summer or for the interviews. And if not this summer, don't take that as bad news. We really are very selective. Since we can only take one person, or perhaps two people at most, it says a lot about these two guys that they both got 1L offers, and how much we think of them. But we would be happy to have a lot of people that we couldn't give interviews to, or couldn't make offers to the first time a shot at us in the 2L process. So, thanks for coming, and I hope that was helpful.